I'm Ken Nash.
And I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And we're Building Bridges.
Indeed we are. We're going to be looking at the urgent call to end migrant detention and strengthen asylum protections.
Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land. Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that Twin Cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my light beside the golden door. Emma Lazarus.
Well, you're listening to Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. And we are now looking at, we lift our light beside the golden door. The huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Gorgeous, beautiful, wonderful sentiment. The core values, but the promises that are unrealized of this country. Well, that takes us directly to the wonderful director of programs, Helena Olea, who is with Alianza Americas, one of the largest and most important immigrants' rights organization in the country. And we're about to talk about an urgent call to end migrant detention and strengthen asylum protections and something good that's happening for migrants and asylum seekers in the Windy City. Helena, we really welcome you and compliment you always on the enormously important and strenuous work that you do for the migrant community, for those seeking asylum.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm very glad to be joining the program.
Well, I want to start with something that very seldom gets raised, and that is the issue of, shall we say, forced migration. What are the responsibilities, what are the issues, the policies and practices, really, of this government, of this country, that too often are forcing people to migrate? And it's perfectly fine, as far as I'm concerned, for people to traverse borders to seek material benefit. People have to live. An artificial creation of nation states is not the issue. But within that, let's look at the U.S. and what is forcing the more recent, let's say, the last 10 years of migratory activity and also people seeking asylum.
Well, I think that's a very important question, and we seldomly ask ourselves that question. We tend to look at migration from within a country and think about the people who are already in the country, but we forget to ask ourselves what is driving people to leave their own countries. And I think the first premise is people in general like to live in their own countries, within their communities, with their families, in their environments, within their culture. And so the decision to leave is really a measure of last resort, an effort to try to find the safety and the dignity that they are not finding at home. It's a desperate action. Most of the time we see that migrants are regularly a group of very strong individuals, curious, adventurous, courageous, who decide to take great risks in search of a better life. And I think that that's crucial. Now, the people, the policies that are driving people to leave are based, on the one hand, on the economic model that it has been put in place, where some countries are producing commodities that are sold at very low prices for the benefit of industrialized societies. And I think that that's really at the core of the recent, the economic situation in most countries of Latin America, who are still a part of a this model of selling commodities, who have not been able to develop strong industries. And so they are really at a very volatile state. The pandemic is a reflection of how weak those states are. Latin America, for instance, lost all of the progress it had made in a decade in its fight against poverty. And we could see, you know, 2 years after the pandemic started, just to give you an example, children were only beginning to return to school in Honduras. So all of the children schooled in public school in Honduras are going to have a 2-year gap in their education, for instance. And it's things like that which set whole countries behind. Also, we need to think and understand the U.S. foreign policy and its impact in the region. To give you an example, in the case of Venezuela, the policies that have been put in place have really impacted on the economy of Venezuela, but the economic sanctions put in place by the United States have further destroyed the Venezuelan economy. And it's precisely the lack of jobs, the lack of resources, the lack of food, what is has driven over 6 million Venezuelans out of the country trying to seek a life of dignity elsewhere, both in South America, and many are now looking into and trying to get to the to North America, particularly to the U.S.
And what would you...
So it's a combination of policies and practices that have been taken, you know, decades that are impacting on many of these countries.
And Helena, what would you say also about the issues of U.S. seeking hegemony in the world and certainly over the continent? And they're very militarist, imperialist, if you will. There's the economic component, but there is a war mentality and an anti-left posture that has sought to destroy the indigenous governments of the progressive states as they have arisen for decades and decades now throughout Latin America. Is that also, how does that come into play in driving people from their lands, from their heritage, from their culture?
It continues to be a very important factor. The U.S. has continued providing some form of military aid, training, and even equipment to different countries in Latin America at different moments to fight against guerrillas, most recently to fight against organized crime, particularly drug trafficking. And there are great concerns in terms of the human rights abuses that are being perpetrated by those police and military forces who are receiving that equipment and that training. That continues to be part of the challenges and the problems in the region. I think it's also important to underscore that, as you were mentioning, it's like barely the Cold War has left Latin America. Now we are in this very difficult position in which Latin American countries are being pressured to decide whether they want stronger ties with China or they want stronger ties with the United States, and they are in desperate need of resources and economic aid. And so in some cases, they just, you know, will get closer to any country that is willing to help them with any form of resources.
Title 42 has lapsed. That was tied in with the pandemic. And we've reverted to Title 8. How does that affect migration?
Well, I think it's a very important question because Title 42, in principle, had closed the border to asylum seekers that were trying to enter the U.S. through its southern border. And this, of course, we have to keep in mind, are the poorest who do not have a visa and who most of them travel by foot or different forms of transportation by road to finally get to the U.S. There had been some exceptions created, particularly during the Biden administration, but the majority of asylum seekers were prevented from entering the country. Now, we are back to Title 8, which is the regular immigration policies of the country. However, a new asylum rule has been put in place and is being implemented by the Biden administration, which is heavily restricting the ability of individuals to enter the U.S. to seek asylum. Briefly, they need to obtain an appointment via a phone application that's called CBP-1. Only at this moment that has been increased, only 1,250 appointments are granted every day. So there are thousands of individuals in the Mexican side of the border waiting, trying every day to get an appointment. They can't schedule appointments ahead of time, so it's really like a lottery. They have every day to click on the phones, hoping that they are able to obtain that appointment. And they are waiting in desperate conditions, both from a humanitarian perspective and also from a protection perspective. There are great risks to their life and to their safety while they are waiting in Mexico, and that is definitely a problem. There are a few exceptions, and I think it's important to point out, that have been granted for individuals who can seek parole, and that implies that they need a sponsor in the U.S., and through that sponsor, they are allowed to enter the country. And those are individuals from Venezuela, Nicaragua, Haiti, and Cuba. Those individuals can be paroled, and this has become an opportunity for those countries. But I think it's also important to underscore, many individuals are waiting and are desperately seeking a sponsor so that they are allowed to come to the U.S.
Now, I know that the approach of Alianza Americas has not been, okay, we've got to get, which we all want. We don't all want, but many of us want, and people have fought for years, which is comprehensive immigration reform. So what they've done is they've kind of parsed out strategic issues relevant to the moment. So let's look at some of the issues of the groups that have come here, such as the Haitians and others who have come in catastrophic situations, and their status and the likelihood of them being tossed back into utter chaos and deprivation, the issue of DACA, etc. So if you could parse out for us a couple of what you think are the strategic issues that have been on the agenda of groups like Alianza and in the leadership groups like Alianza America for, what are the things that we need to advocate for with people such as yourself? Again, we're speaking with Helena Olea, who is the Director of Programs of Alianza Americas.
Well, I think, yeah, we don't believe that the strategy of trying to advocate for a comprehensive immigration reform has been successful. We have been trying that for 20 years, and that has definitely not worked. So we have identified specific policies that address the needs of specific communities, and we think that this is a way to try to pass specific measures one at a time and trying to address some of the greatest challenges of the immigration system. So I can name a few. There's the community of individuals who were granted what is called temporary protective status, TPS. The idea is that this is a measure that allows those individuals who sign up into that program not to be deported back to their country, and they are granted a work authorization. But this is a temporary measure that needs to be renewed periodically. So these individuals some of them, for instance, from El Salvador, have had TPS status for 20 years. They have lived under this temporary status. But in 20 years, you grow up, you fall in love, you create families, you create businesses, you get a mortgage and a home. People try to move forward. So they have lived, even though their status is temporary, they really have created roots and families in the U.S. So there is the need to create a legislative path that allows those individuals with TPS to request a permanent residence in the U.S. so that they can become green card holders and they can think that they have their future safe in the United States. That's one specific policy we are advocating for, as well as a similar path for those individuals who arrive to the country as children and who were benefited with the DACA program that was put in place by the Obama administration. That is a second group also that's very concerned as a result of the litigation and the efforts by the Trump administration to put an end both to DACA, to the DACA program, as well as to the TPS program. So we believe that those individuals who, for all practical purposes, have been in the U.S. for a long time, are Americans, feel American, they need to be granted a permanent resident status. We are also advocating for other type of temporary measures to, other type of measures to address the specific needs of other communities who have also been in the country for a long time in irregular status, but that have also created families, for instance, individuals of Mexican citizenship who have not had access to this TPS status, even though the largest proportion of DACA holders are young, are individuals who arrived to the U.S. as children from Mexico. And there are other measures that would definitely create a huge impact, such as allowing individuals, once they have filed for an asylum application, to immediately obtain a work authorization. Currently, they have to wait 5 months to file for that work authorization. We believe that if individuals were able to work early on, they would be able to become economically independent sooner, and that would definitely be an important measure, just to mention a few of the measures we're advocating for, as well, of course, as to end immigration detention, because we believe that's definitely not the way to handle immigration flow.
So we are dealing with people who, as you indicated earlier, are forced to migrate as a result of climate change, violence, political instability, many of which occur and create humanitarian crisis as a result of the very policies that are driven by the capitalist system, by the U.S. system, and the U.S. system for hegemony, which is most often achieved by virtue of war and economic control and exploitation. Now, with this, what do we say about, how do you rate the Biden administration relative to the Trump administration? Because it's looking more and more fearful for some of us that the administration is willing to tolerate. Could it be, again, since we were earlier talking about children, the separation of families and children? What should we understand and pressure this administration on, aside from the things that you were talking about in terms of getting, making sure that people are able to stay here and are permanentized and get work authorizations?
I think the greatest challenge has been the fact that the Trump administration succeeded in establishing a narrative that immigrants are not welcome into the U.S., that they represent some type of danger, and that immigration has to be halted at all means and strategies possible. And even though the Biden administration has changed its rhetoric and it's not demonizing immigrants, it has not really developed a very strong counter-narrative that continues to highlight the importance and the contributions that migrants make to the U.S. economy, the fact that we create families in the U.S., and that we are a positive force to this country. And so that's why every single immigration measure is developed with a lot of fear of the backlash of the Republican Party. And unfortunately, this administration has not been able to create that momentum and that stance, insisting of why it is pro-immigrant. And that's really where the narrative battle is lost, and that's where we need a stronger strategy. And I think the fact that we don't have a counter-narrative in favor of migration is what did not allow the first 2 years of the Biden administration, when it had some political capital and greater leverage in Congress, to try to pass some of these measures that I mentioned earlier. And that's why right now we have very timid measures. And some of the policies that I described regarding the end of Title 42, like that asylum rule, are really in an effort to try to appease those that very strong anti-immigrant sentiment. And I think that that's really the core of the problem, that we need to acknowledge that the U.S. economy needs migrants, and also that the U.S. is a country of migrants, and that migrants are welcome and that contribute to build this nation.
Perhaps helping us out in to constructing a counter-narrative is the action that the Chicago City Council played, signed by the mayor, in welcoming newly arrived migrants. Could you tell us about what they're doing and how that's working out, and whether other people are picking up on that?
Yeah, and whether that Windy City will blow its good breeze over to the rest of us.
Yes, well, we were very happy to see that in response to the measures undertaken by the governors of Texas and Arizona, who are busing immigrants to the city of Chicago, what the city council approved was a specific budget of $51 million, acknowledging that the city needs resources so that it can offer housing, food, transportation, and legal services to the migrants who have already arrived to the city and to the ones that it foresees that it's coming in the future. The city is facing a number of challenges in terms of having the spaces and the resources to respond to these needs of these newcomers. And so we were very pleased to see the city council, under the leadership of the new mayor, Brandon Johnson, to adopt this measure, underscoring that it's the city needs to be able to address the needs of its population and to address the needs of newcomers and understand that they represent an opportunity for the city. And I think it's important that we see this measure undertaken by Chicago as a kind of an example of what we can do and how we can welcome new arrivals, and that can really be a powerful accelerator for cities and for towns who need a young population that is ultimately going to be, you know, future engines of those communities.
An immediate work authorization?
Absolutely. They need immediate work authorization. However, I think it's also important to underscore that there is a lot of work that civil society organizations are trying to do in that period, while individuals do not have a work authorization in terms of how they can learn about, you know, jobs in the U.S., labor laws, how they can register their children into school, how they can become citizens in a new environment, hopefully even learn a little bit of English to make that process, that integration process possible. But definitely they were able to, the sooner they're able to work, the more they will be able to stand on their own feet and integrate into the U.S.
So let's make that poem that we heard, The Great Colossus by Emma Lazarus, a reality and not just some sentimental feelings from a bygone era. Let's make sure that we expand the political imagination and traditional boundaries and foster inspiration for freedom, equity, and justice, just like our dear friend Helena Olena has, and the marvelous organization Alianza Americas. And your last 30 seconds for us to talk about migration pathways that welcome more migrants. Your thoughts?
Well, I think we need to look at asylum law in the United States and consider how it expands and updates to the current realities and challenges that are forcing people to leave, including climate change, as you mentioned earlier. That's part of our list of very important future action.
Well, considering that we're all on Lenape land from where we're broadcasting, this is Building Bridges with
Ken Nash
and Mimi Rosenberg, and we do just that. We build bridges to educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people and our sibling immigrants. And thank you for helping us do that, Helena Olea, and support our immigrant siblings and those seeking asylum. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. It was really a pleasure to be in the program.
The pleasure's all ours.
All
and
ours.
Again, we've been speaking with Helena Orlea, Director of Programs of Alianza Americas. Thanks for listening.